This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Welcome to episode 259 of the Monocle Weekly, with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Coming up on this show, we'll learn why 30,000 people turned out to watch the execution of the man known as the Prince of Poisoners.
That's right. We'll learn more about one of England's most notorious serial killers with the author Stephen Bates.
Plus, American commentator PJ O'Rourke joins us in the studio to tell us why he thinks his country's made a complete mess of remaking the world.
And we celebrate this year's World Cup finals with the head of a London gallery who's put together the city's largest exhibition dedicated to the tournament.
And we'll play you some great music and preview this week's news with Daniel Giacopelli. That's all coming up on this edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Oh, it's a nice Sunday, isn't it, Tom?
Lovely to be back here, Rob, yeah.
Are you happy?
Pretty much. Been away for a few days. I know you have as well, but we're here primed for what I think is going to be a very special edition of the Monocle Weekly.
I like the way you said that. You said that with a certain amount of italicised irony, perhaps some inverted commas around it. I hope you're not.
It came straight from
casting
the heart.
Aspersions.
No, it came straight from the heart.
This fine and august programme.
No, this is one of my favourite shows, Rob, as you're surely aware.
We've got some decent guests sort of lined up for today. I'm kind of looking forward to our man who's written the book about the poisoner.
I'm slightly scared about that because it's very sort of macabre subject matter. I'm worried it'll be the stuff of waking nightmares.
Do you think, I mean, our guests get put in a green room, don't they, before they come to be grilled? Or lightly. Sort of. They'll come out more like Taliata.
Exactly.
Still raw, perhaps,
exactly.
On this show, because this isn't a grilling kind of show, is it?
It's kind of gentle.
Fireside chat.
Yeah, fireside chat.
But I wonder if he accepted a coffee from our good people on the front desk.
He might have been reticent. Maybe it's made him paranoid.
I know.
Maybe
when
I should ask him about
research,
that.
I wonder what happens to you potentially.
Uncovering this, it's very much scratching the sordid underbelly of Victorian Britain.
And we've got PJ O'Rourke coming up on the show. Sadly, though, we have to tell our listeners that that was recorded a couple of weeks ago. I think Andrew Miller did that interview.
Indeed.
It's a bit of a shame, isn't it?
It is a shame.
PJ O'Rourke, and he's one of my heroes.
He's absolutely great. Well, you know, sort of, what do you call him? Raconteur, wit,
yeah.
Writer. He's a polymath.
Okay. Shall I say Renaissance man? I guess I just have. I wish I hadn't. What I like about PJ O'Rourke also is his look. He's got a great look. I saw him walking across the street for a drink into Hardy's with, I think, his daughters, and he's got a very cool look. He hasn't really sort of changed his look since, I guess, the early 80s, has he?
Yeah. No, he's very much wearing his sort of power suit from that era.
Yeah.
He still wears it well. It's a bit kind of, you know, languid around the edges, but the man's got style. He's got enduring style.
But I tell you what isn't dog-eared.
What's that?
Man's brain, wit, and charisma.
Absolutely.
Should we head headlong into the programme?
Absolutely.
And wheel out Mr. Daniel Giacopelli. I say wheel him out. I wonder if he's got a theme tune. If not, we'll just play what's known as a sting. And here he is, Danny. Welcome to the programme. How's it going?
It's going very, very well, Rob. How's everything here?
It's all shipshape and Bristol fashion.
That's
good.
Thank
you very much.
You ready for my topics?
I'm very ready for your topics. You printed them out and handed them to us, which I've never had before. I like it.
It's a brief. And we're going to start out in Spain, which actually today hosts the baby jumping festival, or competition, or ritual, really, depending on. I helpfully printed out photos. So what this is, it's a medieval ritual where they put babies in this village in the center of the square, and they have grown men jump over the babies to kind of get the evil out of them. So it's a religious festival.
Danny, does this pass health and safety muster? Because I'm looking at some of the pictures you've added here. This guy's wearing a pretty flamboyant outfit. He's got what looks to be like some kind of paddles and another staff, and he's basically leaping over a mattress of infants. That looks like an accident waiting to happen.
Oh, yeah, but it's fun, Tom. I mean, have you been to Pamplona before?
How stupid of me.
I like how he's dressed up. He's dressed up as a sort of pignolo.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
A commedia dell'arte sort of clown. How is this man chosen? Is a new man in every village each year?
You know, I don't know how they...
How is the jumper chosen?
I don't know how they choose the jumper, but he represents the devil. He's wearing a brightly red and yellow covered uniform, and he's jumping over about four or five different babies with the parents gleefully looking on as they take photos with their Kodak cameras.
How long has this been going on for, Danny? This is quite ancient, isn't it?
It's quite many centuries.
Wow.
So find your way over to Castrillo de Mercia in Spain if you want to see it. Today, it's happening.
It's a little bit late for us, but that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary.
Who needs the World Cup when you've got this? This is just the kind of thing that's probably on Eurosport 3.
I'd love to hear the commentary to that one.
I'd love to hear that. And there he goes. And here he is. What do you think he's called?
Is he named in your dossier that you provided for us?
Yeah, he's called the Colacho, Colacho.
Colacho, yeah.
Which means something. He's the devil.
It's the feast. It's the Corpus Christi feast, isn't it?
Exactly.
The body of Christ feast.
It is. Shall we move on to New York?
Oh, you make me feel hungry.
Bob Dylan's handwritten lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone, they're going to be sold at auction by Sotheby's. This is happening on the 24th. I've helpfully shown photos of what it looks like, but they're probably going to go for many hundreds of thousands.
Do you think they'll throw the bums a dime in their prime for this piece of work?
Well, wouldn't you?
I would. Wouldn't you?
I like this. So these are actually, it's actually written. These are the original composition was written on the Roger Smith Hotel notepaper out of D.C.
Yeah, no, they're quite, I mean, I would love to buy these if I had a couple hundred thousand.
It's a small doodle of what looks like is that a chicken?
it is a chicken.
I think it's a chicken in a hat.
And it's a...
Hang on, is there a picture of
it? Yeah. Is it a chicken in a hat there at the bottom, Rob? What do you make of that? And some kind of deer, is that with antlers?
It's a four-page working draft.
That's pretty nice. These are kind of a bit like John Lennon's lyrics. He was a pretty good cartoonist, wasn't he? And he similarly kind of scribbled all over his lyrics. And if he couldn't think of a rhyme, he'd draw a picture of something and it would help him kind of make the connection between one verse and the next. That is a pretty amazing thing. I also think so many great things have probably been written on hotel stationery. I think there's a great collection of stuff that could just be... I think, and also, if this hotel still exists in Washington, D.C., they should buy it and have it in their lobby. That's a wonderful thing to do. Wouldn't you want to stay in the room that Bob Dylan wrote Like a Rolling Stone in? I mean,
is the hotel still there,
Danny? A bit of branding.
Have you done your research thoroughly for this?
No idea if this place is still there. I would assume it's still there. I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
There's a number on there. Let's ring them up. Let's ring them up live. It's a new section.
Next on the Monica
Weekly. Testing out if the news look ahead really
Fact
works.
Fact-checking.
Yeah.
With Robert Bound.
That's great.
I really love that.
I hope they do buy that.
Yeah, it is great. A bit of a downer before we end with something.
Oh, thanks, Danny. That's a narrative arc.
It's the anniversary of Franz Ferdinand's assassination. This is on the 28th of June.
I know they haven't had a hit in a while, but come on.
100 years, Rob, since he was killed and may or may not have sparked World War I. Yeah. I know we've been looking at this quite a bit on Monocle 24, but the actual day is coming up this week.
And this is celebrated and commemorated in different ways, isn't it?
By
Gavrilo Princip and people that are still agree with his worldview, kind of commemorate the death of Franz Ferdinand and the event that sparked World War One in quite a different way, don't they, depending upon which bit of that part of the world you're from.
Yeah, and I'm sure in Sarajevo they're also celebrating it in different ways than they are in Vienna.
And it was such a shame for This Day in Fashion was a website. That would be a sad day. Because, man, he loved a plumed hat, didn't he? Franz Ferdinand.
Very handsome moustache.
Yeah, well, he was a handsome man.
From that representation there.
Leave it to
is
you.
That a, is that a handlebar? Is that what that is?
I think that's a handlebar.
Handlebar.
Shall we end in nearby Austria? Rob, the World Body Painting Festival takes place.
So I was just looking at the other thing on the sidebar that you printed out for the internet. Some stories there that probably we shouldn't talk about on the radio.
That might have been my Google ads.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, they've obviously suited them to your Google search. That could take literally thousands of man hours to correct.
Check out these photos, gentlemen. It's the World Body Painting Festival in Austria on the 29th, so a week from today.
Okay.
It's the largest such body painting event, I think, in the world. But they're quite, they're really fascinating kind of works of art. So it's naked people with amazing things painted on them. What can't you love about that?
I think that's quite sexy, actually.
I have virtually nothing to say about this.
You can't be like that. This is a topic.
But you'd like to take that home with you, wouldn't you, Tom?
I don't think I would. These are quite... What are they doing?
Do you want to be a painter or a paintee?
I'd probably rather be a paintee, actually.
You'd rather be naked standing in front of a crowd? I'd rather be a painter.
Because you're naked, but you don't look naked.
So what you're saying is you wish you were naked, but you can't get away with it,
Yeah,
you?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's a pretty frank revelation to kick off the weekly this week.
That's one of Monocle 24's key producers. Next time you listen to Daniel Giacopelli presenting the entrepreneurs, just imagine...
Just think of me naked.
...what he's wearing and try and think about whether he's a good man to present a business show.
There we are.
I like all of these things. Oh, here we go. I didn't get to the back page.
That's the best part.
I was just going to wonder, Rob, which, if you had to be a paintee, though, what paintee would you be out of these selections? What about that one in the bottom left you've got there? The sort of strange cones coming out.
Oh, that's really strange. It's a bit like some sort of... that's very sci-fi, isn't it? I quite like this one. I'd paint her.
Yeah, she's got sort also, of, is that like a chicken's head again?
If you do want to attend, there's the Body Circus, which is the surreal ballroom event.
Every day is a body circus time.
35 workshops.
35, you say?
I like that. I'm thinking that that's probably a Monocle film waiting to happen. Someone get upset.
Someone send Gillian to buy us.
Exactly. Is that the extent of the news locker, Danny?
That's all I have. I thought I shan't bring down serious things today.
No, it's all right. It's good. We're going to have a bit of light and shade, I think, on this show.
That's just the body paint.
Exactly. Is that a shadow? Oh, no, it's not. I wish it was. Daniel, thank you very much indeed for your news look ahead. And we can dispatch you into the summer Sunday sun in London.
Into my birthday suit wilderness.
You're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards. Charles Dickens once described Dr. William Palmer as the greatest villain who ever stood trial at the Old Bailey. Other nicknames include the Prince of Poisoners and Palmer the Poisoner. Dr. Palmer was convicted and executed in 1856 for murdering his best friend, but it's his other crimes for which we remember him.
Palmer was suspected of poisoning more than a dozen other people, including his wife, brother, mother-in-law, even children. Also, he could cash in on their life insurance policies and fund his gambling habit. So what is it about this serial killer that made headlines all around the world? Well, joining us here in the studio is Stephen Bates, author of The Poisoner, The Life and Crimes of Victorian England's Most Notorious Doctor. Stephen, welcome to the programme. It's hard not to affect a sort of an accent, a sense of that era of Victorian intrigue. What is it particularly about, if you could boil it down, about this character that made the story so compelling and all around the world too? Was it the first of that sort of brand of super criminals? What was it about the man, do you think?
I think it was the difference between what people expected of a criminal in those days, a sort of Fagin-like figure, strange, knobbly-headed, eyes too close together, eyebrows meeting in the middle, and a man who was a respectable Midlands doctor, a churchgoer, a family man, supposedly, and very, very ordinary. Charles Dickens, who covered the case, wrote to one of his friends and said, "Everywhere I go, I see Palmer. Palmer is next to me. Palmer is in front of me at the theatre."
It's a very popular surname.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. And I've worked with several Palmers, but none of them poisoners, as far as I know. But it was the ordinariness of the man and the notoriety of his crimes that absolutely fascinated Victorian England.
And I wondered to what extent, Stephen, writing this book also served as a cautionary tale at the times. It was obviously a time of great innovation, medical innovation. Poisoning, presumably, it goes back, obviously, to Roman times, very famous few people that have used poisoning to get their way. But presumably this was something that was becoming difficult to trace. It was a sign of the times, this crime as well.
Yes, perhaps. It was a new scientific age, you know, the Industrial Revolution and all that. And new poisons were being discovered all the time. They were sort of offshoots of the chemical developments in the Industrial Revolution. Strychnine was a poison that had only been known about 20 years. It's actually a vegetable poison from trees in the Far East, which, of course, hadn't been available before. And Palmer was the first person ever to be tried for poisoning his best friend, as it turned out, with strychnine, which is a pretty horrible, particularly nasty poison. It throttles you within about 10 or 15 minutes. And so to have your best friend writhing and in convulsions and screaming in front of you and yet watch him die seemed particularly terrible to Victorians.
Let me ask you, Stephen, a bit about the sort of the public appetite then at the time for news of this man and of these crimes. Do you think it was a very different age in terms of what people, the capacity people had for the kinds of detail, or do you think there's always been that sort of salacious detail? People like to read about that in the press, and that's really, we see an evolution of that even still to this day.
Yeah, I mean, I think the public appetite for reading about criminals, particularly dastardly ones, was as great then as it is now. And they had extra opportunities then. You could go and see the man hang, which, of course, you can't do anymore. But he was someone who ought to have been trusted. He was a family doctor. He was someone you would go to hopefully get cured. And yet he was killing people. And I think that's one of the elements of the fascination for the case. The other element was that newspaper taxes had just been relieved. And so newspapers were suddenly very much cheaper. It's your main source of news, of course, in those days. And so newspapers were freely available. They weren't very expensive anymore. And you could get them in a little country like Britain the next morning. And so people were absolutely fascinated and couldn't get enough of this crime.
I mean, you mentioned that he seemed to be sort of an ordinary guy. I mean, he was obviously a professional man, but it was gambling debts that were the reason that people felt that he had to go around murdering people to claim their life insurance. Can you paint a little picture of as much we know about the man? I know the book starts with the first picture is of him at the races with his betting slips in hand. What was that scene like?
There are extraordinary contemporary resonances. You know, he got into debt with moneylenders, who were the sort of 19th century equivalent of payday loan companies these days, charging huge amounts of interest on debts. He was having to find about £1,000 a month just to service his debts, which is about £23,000, £24,000, £25,000 a month these days. He got into trouble because he got fascinated by racing. He kept horses, which he couldn't afford, and mostly they lost races. And the best friend, who was the man he was charged and convicted of poisoning, won a race with his racehorse at Shrewsbury. And funnily enough, within a few days, was feeling very sick. And his money all disappeared by the time he died a week later. And Palmer seemed to have a little bit of money after that. So there was a suspicion that he might have had something to do with it.
And I take it your book is not just a straight story of Palmer and his crimes and the way that it was covered by Dickens and the like. But there's a revisionist side to it as well. There's a bit of doubt in your mind as to whether his face fitted everything that he was supposed to have done.
Yes, that's certainly true. He was a classic victim of what nowadays we'd say was tabloid journalism. I've said that newspapers were fascinated by this gruesome crime that he was supposed to have committed. They sent reporters up to this little Midlands town of Rugeley en masse, just as you would do today. I used to work at the Daily Mail, so I recognise some of the resonances there. And they sent reporters round, and within a few days they were reporting that he was probably responsible for half the suspicious deaths in the area over the previous 10 years. The modern concern about prejudicing trials is nothing new. There was considerable prejudice about Palmer before he ever came to trial. Everyone knew that he'd probably killed a dozen or 15 or was it 20 people. None of this had to be proved, but all of it was in the public prints long before he came to trial. So he was almost convicted before he ever stood in the Old Bailey dock. He was probably guilty of at least the murder he was tried for, but he certainly wasn't the sort of rapacious serial killer that the Victorian press painted him as.
I just wanted to ask you a bit more about his profession, because there's a number of doctors throughout modern British history who've been accused or have been found guilty of crimes of this sort. Do you think there is something about that profession and the fact that it involves people, in many cases, literally opening themselves up, that makes people a little uneasy? And perhaps it's rather easy to demonise practitioners of medicine. It's something that we've seen quite often, both in fiction and in real life.
That's absolutely true. And that was certainly one of the elements in this case, because doctors then, as now, had access, much easier access, to chemical substances. And people were very scared that a doctor might poison you. And in fact, there was quite a track record already in the Victorian period of doctors poisoning their wives and wives poisoning their doctor husbands simply because of the availability of poison. And Palmer fitted precisely into this scare. There's a quote in the book from a contemporary newspaper, which said, how do you know your husband isn't poisoning your curry? And this was certainly a considerable middle class scare. You could certainly see the Daily Mail, for instance, of the day saying something like that, you know, page six, why oh why is your husband poisoning you? These are things that have a sort of permanent resonance, and certainly you can see that in the Palmer case.
And it's an interesting point you pick up on there. I wanted to ask you, Tom asked a question earlier that was sort of about bound up in the grisliness of certain elements of Victoriana, of which these crimes are certainly part. How much do you think times have changed? You mentioned the Daily Mail might cover these crimes and this trial in exactly the same way as it would have done in the 1880s.
I started off being interested in this case, thinking it was a piece of period Victorian Gothic melodrama. And indeed, there are elements of that in it, you know, sort of flickering candlelight and hotel bedrooms in Victorian England. But I was amazed at some of the contemporary resonances, not only the media and how they covered the case in that time, but things like the ease with which Palmer was able to take out insurance policies on his victims. You can't do that anymore, but in those days you could take out an insurance policy, kill the person on who you'd taken out the policy, and then claim the payback. Palmer was certainly attempting to do that, and journalists who went round the insurance companies, the life insurance companies in London at that stage, found that all the salesmen were working on commission and they weren't going to be too careful or too worried about offering policies on people whose lives were clearly not going to last very long. So there are a lot of those sorts of contemporary feelings which chime with today. And again, as I say, the moneylenders were sending very threatening letters to Palmer, which was what drove him into the corner of killing people, I suspect. They were pretty unforgiving. If you don't pay up by the end of the week, you'll only have yourself to blame. You know, that's pretty chilling stuff.
It is pretty chilling. I was going to ask you about that because there are these stories of Victoriana. They're often very macabre. But I wonder, as a writer, when you're actually researching this and writing it, is it difficult? I mean, do you find that you have to keep yourself detached because it's very dark, grisly, the macabre detail? Does it sort of pollute your mind with dark thoughts? Or or do you manage to keep that a sort of a healthy, I don't know, distance almost from your subject matter?
Well, I suppose I'm fascinated by true crime. I was quite surprised at the detail that the Victorian journalists put into this. They were quite happy to report things that we would never report today, I mean, colour of vomit, all that sort of stuff. And they literally published every cough and spit, which, as an old hack myself, I'm terribly impressed that they were as assiduous as they were. But I sometimes wonder how they got away with it.
With not a little grisliness, we end the interview. Stephen Bates, thank you very much. The book is The Poisoner, The Life and Crimes of Victorian England's Most Notorious Doctor, and it's out now. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for some music now, Tom. What do you think we should have?
Rob, I'm not sure. I think you should pick something.
I was holding up the CD cover so you could read it out in some weird link way.
No, I know, but you've obscured one of the titles with your fingers. why don't you choose, Rob?
That was such a smooth link. And we're going to have something new from one of my favourite artists, Jar Wobble. Jar Wobble's called Jar Wobble. He's actually called John Wardle. He's called Jar Wobble because he was sort of, I think he hung out with the Sex Pistols. He's been in many backing bands and all the rest of it. I think Sid Vicious was very drunk one day and couldn't pronounce John Wardle. So he was like, I'll take that with me. Jar Wobble presents, therefore, this is PJ Higgins. It's from a new record called Inspiration, and this is King of Illusion. Yeah, you better remember where you say, yeah. In desperate just to take you play. That was King of Illusion, new from Jar Wobble Presents PJ Higgins. The album's called Inspiration. It's out now. PJ O'Rourke made his name making fun of other places and other people with a series of matchlessly funny gonzo travel books, including Holidays in Hell, Give War a Chance, and All the Trouble in the World. O'Rourke has now taken a similarly satirical look at his own generation of Americans, and by extension, himself. O'Rourke's latest book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and Why It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again.
It explains how the people born into the wealth and possibility of post-war America were presented with an unprecedented opportunity to remake the world and made a more or less total mess of it. Monocle's Andrew Muller caught up with PJ O'Rourke here at Midori House a little earlier.
PJ, welcome to Monocle 24.
Well, thank you.
You're addressing your own generation, the baby boom, in your book, The Baby Boom. I was struck by a number of observations in it, but substantially that the thing that everybody credits the baby boom for was the music and the art and the liberal political leadership, all of which you point out was actually done by a previous generation while the baby boom stood around and clapped. The baby boom you credit mostly for having given the world bullshit, as you put
yes,
it.
Yes, I do. You know, and actually a very valuable thing it was. You know, I mean, it is, as Churchill said, better to jaw than to war, you know. And so, yes, we're all talk and not an overmuch action. I really think that's a better sort of world to live in, but that may be because I talk a lot.
A lot of baby boom is, or your book, The Baby Boom, is rooted in, it's kind of a childhood memoir. Was the childhood your own kids are having half a century later much of a reference point for that?
It is pretty different. But then again, I grew up in a sort of a city suburb, you know, kind of, you know, place with detached houses and little lawns, but still with inside the city limits, very ordinary. So I had this very median childhood. I'm a very median person, you know, in all these terms.
But the vision of your childhood you summon up in The Baby Boom, I think you, the phrase you use is the shining suburb on the hill. It is quite a... it does actually sound fairly and unapologetically idyllic. It sounds like it was a great time to be an American kid.
It really was, you know. I mean, there wasn't too much on television, so we weren't stuck inside, you know, glued to the tube, you know. When it comes to things that seem to oppress modern children, bullying, for instance. I mean, you know, in our day and age, you could be detested at school, or you could be detested at home, or if you were very unlucky, you could be detested in both places. But that was it, you know. You couldn't be detested 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Well, potentially by the entire planet.
Yes, exactly.
If you tweet something especially stupid.
Yeah, your detestability never went viral, you know. And if you happened to move, you know, or you went on, you know, from grade school to high school and stuff, you could adopt a new persona, you know, and become less detestable. Or whatever, you know.
It is that terrible burden, I guess, that kids your age will have to carry around, that they will always have to carry around the childhood or their childhood or younger selves. Writers have the option of doing that. This isn't this is not the first time you've grappled with the younger PJ. You did that previously on Age and Guile.
Yes, I did, yeah.
What do you think of him now? When you were writing about your teenage and 20-something self, did you like him?
Not very much, no. I really didn't. Although this is... to the extent this book is memoir qualities to it, but you know the memoir as it is done today, the modern memoir is all about how different I am from you, you know, and that wasn't at all what I was trying to do here. I was trying to summon memories that would connect to as many people in my generation, specifically in America, as possible. I was trying to take a little yeast of my memory and put it in the bread dough of other people's memories. And the response I wanted was, oh, not so, God, what a story. You know, I mean, the response I wanted was, yeah, we used to do that too, you know, or I remember that, or that, yeah, that is the way that actually happened as opposed to the way we, you know, publicly remember it.
You talk at some length about the lengths you went to avoid being drafted for Vietnam and rather beat up on yourself for it. I think I remember you dedicating Age and Guile to whoever it was who had to go in your place.
I'm not sure whether it was Gage and Guile, but it was one of my books.
You yes, definitely I dedicated
did.
A book to...
Because it was a zero-sum game. If you didn't go, someone else did have to go.
Do you still regret that, or do you regret
absolutely.
That?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it was a wrong decision, and... There's really no excuse for not having gone, except it was also a wrong war. And it was clear by the time that I finally got drafted, which was in 1970, you know, it was completely clear that not only weren't we going to win this war, but we didn't even want to win this war. I mean, we were trying to negotiate our way out of it by then, you know, and to be sent off as cannon fodder, you know, it was just sort of an insult to oneself. But I remember going down to the draft physical and, you know, we were taken down in buses and stripped to our underwear and we're standing there in our socks and our underwear. And of course, everybody who's wearing boxer shorts and, you know, over the calf length socks has got a big fat envelope from their doctor about how they're allergic to camouflage. You know, something. And everybody, you know, who's wearing the sort of, you know, socks that you get by the bag full at the discount store, you know, and those sort of unfortunate tidy whitey underwear, you know, that comes up over your navel, you know, I mean, they're standing there with empty hands, you know, and off they went, you know. And at that time, I fancied myself to be very left wing, you know, very, very sort of Marxist of some kind. And of course, there I was being shown, you know, class warfare, as it were, you know, and it was actual class warfare, that is to say, the lower classes and the lower middle class was being marched off to war while we in the middle and upper middle class were being shown off the premises. And I didn't take it in at all. You know, I was so self-involved that all I wanted to do was get the hell out of there and not be put in the army.
That theme of self-involvement and the solipsism of the baby boomers is something else you do talk about a lot in the book. Is that, though, just, and this is something you will have noticed being a foreign correspondent, that that kind of self-involvement and solipsism, it's an inevitable product of prosperity and security.
Isn't it just? Yeah. I mean, the aristocratic class had it forever. From the time of ancient Rome or ancient Greece, we see that. You know, I mean, when they're walking around the agora with Socrates and muttering about what is true and, you know, what is right and what is just, you read Plato, you read the dialogues, you're dealing with some deeply self-involved people here, you know, because they're asking about what is right for me, you know, what is, you know. Now, they may be talking about, you know, all sorts of noble self-denying sort of existence, you know, that they intend to lead, but it is me. Nonetheless, it's not a, there's nothing collective about the dialogues, you know, it's two people talking about me. And so what you have with the baby boom is you have an interesting social experiment where all of a sudden you take something, you know, there are 75 million baby boomers, not all of them. Of course, some of them are marginalized economically or marginalized because of racial discrimination. But anyway, you take a vast number of middle-class American kids, and you basically give them what, in a world historical context, would be wealth, privilege, no responsibility.
No, beyond the imagining of anybody who'd come before them.
Yes, precisely. You know, I went back and did the math, and the baby boom, we grew up, our median income was $10,000 more per year than the median income of the greatest generation, a generation that endured the Depression and fought World War II. And that's $10,000 a year in inflation-adjusted dollars. That's a lot. I mean, that's a life-changing amount. Doesn't sound so huge nowadays when we're forever talking about billions and trillions and so on. But $10,000 a year gave us a very different kind of life than our parents had. And the other thing is that that median income started around $10,000 more in the late 40s and just kept going up. I mean, it was a period of steady economic growth, almost no dips in it whatsoever, from shortly after the war until really the Arab oil embargo in the early 70s. And even then, it only plateaued. It didn't dip back hugely. And if you look at the median income from the greatest generation, it goes way down right at the end of World War I. It goes way up during the 1920s, comes crashing back down during the Depression, kind of bounces around down at the sort of bottom of it, and then doesn't start to come back up until we're rearming for World War II. So not only did they have less money, but they had much less income security, as we would say today. So that's got to give you a very different set of attitudes.
Your most recent travel book, full-scale travel book, I guess, Holidays in Heck, was largely about holidaying with your family.
It was, yes.
And do you ever miss the kind of travel that filled its predecessor volume, Holidays in Hell?
Oh, you know, terrifically. Except that, you know, I realized at the end of the Iraq War, you know, that I was too old to be scared stiff and too stiff to sleep on the ground, you know, basically. And by then, I already had two kids, and when I came home, we had a war baby, and, you know, so now there are three kids. The other thing is that the world out there has changed. There is the level of professionalism among foreign correspondents. You know, it used to be the same 200 people or so.
Yeah.
Went to every trouble spot. One of the great things about, no matter how terrible a place you were going to, you'd see all your friends. You know, it was like thing about either you're going to heaven or you're going to hell. And if, you know, if you're going to heaven, you have nothing to worry about. And if you're going to hell, you'll be so busy shaking hands, you know, that you won't have time to worry. And, you know, so that I met these people, you know, first in Lebanon, and I go to cover Marcos' overthrow. And it's the same 200 or so people, you know, and you knew them all, many of them by name and all of them by sight, and they knew you. Now we have a kind of intrusion of, first place doesn't pay like it used to, and they don't have the budgets that they once had. So you don't have the drivers and the minders and the fixers and the translators that we had scads of, you know, and... you don't have the base camp to go back to, you know, that's where there's decent food and booze and things to be found. And the whole world of foreign correspondence is kind of plagued by a bunch of amateurs with iPhones, you know, and forever getting themselves killed and kidnapped and so on. So I miss that, but it isn't there to go back to. I'll be 67 this year, so I've got no business going back to it anyway, but it isn't there to go back to, so... no use missing it.
It would be remiss of us while you're here not to ask you about American politics. The next presidential election is, I guess, about 2.5 years away, which means that people will start campaigning at some point in the next
about
5 minutes
or so.
Yes,
I was going to say, yeah. As we're sitting here.
The party to which you've become attached, the Republican Party, it has not escaped the notice of many people that it has ended up in this very weird position where it now no longer appears possible to get the nomination for the Republican Party unless you're prepared to spend 2 years pretending to be insane, but by which time nobody else apart from the lunatics will vote for you. How does the GOP unshackle itself from that?
Yeah, you're putting it too kindly, I think. So, yeah. Well, a little bit of unshackling seems to be underway. Even the nuttier Republicans have realized that if you don't get elected, nothing that you want is going to happen. Maybe the things that you are maniacal about, you know, are only going to happen if you get your lunatic in. But nothing's going to happen if you don't get elected at all. So the business of nominating people who are simply completely unfit, you know. And so far, more moderate and well-spoken and less crazed and insane Republicans seem to have won their primaries. The Democrats have, of course, a similar problem. Part of this is the way voting districts are determined in the United States, which is by the state legislature. And the tendency of state legislature, no matter who runs it, is to make safe districts for themselves. And yeah, even safe districts for the other party, because then that's like one less district you have to worry about. And so you know the other party's going to. So even if you have a Republican-controlled state legislature, they'll carve up certain areas for the Democrats, you know, so that they just... So we've gotten this very... excessively polarized politics. And the Democrats have a version of the same thing. Their raving loonies tend to win their unelectables also tend to win their primaries. It doesn't get quite as much press as the Americans because the Democratic loonies sort of speak the language of academia and media and the cultural
bullshit, really, to bring us back to bullshit, where we
came yes, in. Yes, bring us back to where we started. Yeah, they speak the bullshit that's in fashion, whereas the bullshit that the Tea Party speaks is rather out of fashion, and so we don't get quite as much press for the bullshit. But Democrats do have the same problem of nominating people that no one really wants to elect.
And just finally, then, have you started thinking as far ahead as a book about the next Clinton presidency?
No. God save us all. No, I don't think there will be a next Clinton presidency, and I don't think the reason has anything that much to do with Hillary herself. I think that while there are 75 million baby boomers, and we do vote like hell, I think there are, you know, there are whatever it is, 320, 330 million Americans, and I think America's kind of had it with the baby boom, you know, enough already. We've had 3 baby boom presidents already, and it's time to let's move on, as they say in American liberal politics.
That was PJ O'Rourke speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller.
Up next, we'll tell you how one London gallery is celebrating this year's World Cup.
Every other summer, the international architecture community sail into Venice to contemplate the world of architecture. This year's Biennale, curated by Rem Koolhaas, was a fundamental study in modernity and national identity. And Monocle Films reports back.
Although patriotism has long been at the heart of the Biennale, with each of the handsome national pavilions lined up in the Giardini, Coolhouse's theme invites reflection on the notion of national style, instead of posturing, self-promotion or peacocking.
Soft Power Ambassadors at the Venice Architecture Biennale, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Now, all month here on Monocle 24, we've been celebrating the highs and lows of this year's World Cup.
Well, one gallery in London is claiming to have curated the most significant World Cup experience London has ever seen. The proud archivist has put together four exhibitions across its entire space, everything from a photographic exhibition on World Cup final goal scorers to a Panini sticker wall of wonder. That is one for me, I can assure you. Joining us for more is Rob Manley from The Proud Archivist. Rob, welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Now, I mean, is there any reason to talk about anything more than a Panini wall of wonder? Because we've talked a lot about our World Cup memories, and I've been trying to sort of date my contemporaries by which World Cup annual they remember. Panini stickers are so sort of, well, iconic, I guess, is the only word. Can it be true? Every single one?
Every single sticker Panini have ever produced for their World Cup collections from the 1970 World Cup through to 2014 Brazil.
That's an amazing thing. Where did this cull come from? Is this a labour of love on your part? Are these a personal collection or have you had to do some swapsies?
It definitely isn't a personal collection. No, it turned into a labour of love.
Yeah.
It started, of course, with the imagination of, well, we have a 60-foot long by 8-foot high light wall in the gallery, a wall illuminated, backlit, onto which we exhibit, we display images. And we had an exhibition planned for the gallery, which was a photographic exhibition by a photographer called Michael Donald, who had embarked on a 2-year or maybe a little bit more journey around the world, finding, photographing and interviewing every living member of the I Scored a Goal in the World Cup Final club.
I love being part of that club.
It is, you know, a very exclusive club, one that Messi, Beckham, lots of Johan Cruyff, no, you know, are not members of. But there were, I think there are 56 people in total since the World Cup began that have ever scored a goal. There were 35 still alive when he started the programme, and 33 made it to our exhibition, and one is hanging in there just, and we wish him well. And then we add to that whoever scores in this year's World Cup final. It remains a very small club. So we look across to our light wall and we say, okay, so what are we going to do here? And just one word cropped up very early on in the little kind of brainstorming session, and it was Panini. And I just immediately went to the idea that what if we had every single World Cup sticker Panini have ever produced, ever, somehow mapped across this entire 60-foot by 8-foot wall. And we laughed out loud because the sheer kind of ridiculousness of the idea was, it was like, well, how could that happen? I mean, there are many reasons how it couldn't happen. But I went straight back to my desk and I kind of looked up on the net, looked up Panini's UK address and phone number. They're out in Tunbridge Wells, which immediately worried me because I just thought, I just imagined this lovely little cosy office, you know, kind of satellite office of Panini's HQ in Italy. And I got through to somebody and they just so happened to be having the busiest time in the history of Panini. Panini this year, for some reason, they're just massively successful.
There's a kind of re-embracing of the analog, isn't there? We've been talking about this in the office, and you know, while we've been watching some of the World Cup matches, that more sticker albums have been sold to probably men of a certain age than to kids. And there's this re-embracing of wanting to have something to collect, right?
Well, you know, and the other thing is, you think about the last generation, if you like, Panini sticker collectors. You know, they're all dads now, and maybe even a few granddads in there. They're going back in droves. So a huge number of the old school, if you like, collectors are going back. So it just, so I tapped into Panini's office in Tunbridge Wells to say, hey, look, we've got this idea. They just said, look, we're the busiest we've ever been and we're a small little office, so just bear with us. And it took some time and some coaxing and some lots of apologetic emails to say, I know you haven't replied to my last email, but eventually I got through to the Panini Art Studio in Italy and they put everything together for me and sent me all the files. So I got my Photoshop kit in and we sat down and we gridded everything across from 1970 to 2014. It's 12 World Cups. We just so happened to have 12 panels that make up our light wall. It was perfect. And then I went to the printers, to a very specialist printers, to print these huge World Cup panels, which were grids of every sticker from each of the World Cup albums.
Sounds like an amazing opportunity to make an amazing haircuts flick book as well, right?
The study of footballers' haircuts yeah. from 70 to 2014 is exceptional. The point at which on that wall moustaches became obsolete is yeah. incredible. Yeah. The big hair of the Chile team of 1984 is just amazing. You can be very nostalgic with it. You can remember your own entry point to Panini World Cup stickers, but you can also just look and wonder at the history
of the mullets in some cases.
Of yeah. footballers, of portraits of footballers over the years. It's fantastic.
It's something about the World Cup, football generally, the World Cup perhaps more specifically, encourages this sort of love of, you know, ephemera and you know, posters or stickers and this kind of thing. I don't know what it is about the event, but it must be a real pleasure to be able to professionally embark on a real scrutiny of that, not just the stickers, but all these other things, because it's such an extensive exhibition. There's so many other things as well, aren't there?
You mean the Proud Archivist exhibition? Mm. Well, I mean, we've got a big space. There's two galleries. There's a library gallery. There's what we call the Lightroom gallery. So we've got the photographic exhibition and the Panini exhibition in the Lightroom gallery. We've also got a big screen in that gallery. So when that big screen comes down and the football's playing, you are actually in the presence of, you know, which is why I called it the most significant World Cup exhibition London's ever seen. Easy for me to say, but I kind of believed it when I was stood in that room, because you have every footballer still alive on the planet, including 2010's Iniesta, right through to Alcides Gigia, who scored for Uruguay in the 1950 World Cup final, scored the winner against Brazil, which brought the country to its knees. It was in Brazil at the Maracanã, which is where this year's World Cup final is being played. So he's the number one on our list, and we've got Iniesta as, you know, the last scorer. But in that room, you are in the presence of World Cup history. And for me, it's a thrill. ESPN this year, they commissioned a Brazilian illustrator called Cristiano Siqueira to illustrate one member of each of the 32 World Cup teams. And the illustrations are just stunning. And I came across them in the press some time ago. And I contacted ESPN and they sent me a set of the 32 prints, which are all high quality screen prints and, you know, 24 by 36s. And they're incredible. So they're up around the gallery and up into the library. It was kind of not so much the last thought, but, you know, what could we do here? Well, we just so happened to come across a chap who had a really extensive collection of World Cup records from over the years. So he also has a project called Art Vinyl, which are just these vinyl frames that you put your 12 inches in and you clip them shut and hang them on your wall. So we had him put his favourite 20 old school World Cup records into these frames, and we've got them in the gallery, and it's really fun and interesting to see. So across the whole gallery, we have a, well, it turned into the World Cup Wonderland, and that's what we've got. It's great. It's really
and do you
great.
Have to make many interventions into the materials you've got, the vinyl record covers or the Panini sticker, you know, the way that they're shot, the quality of the sticker, all the rest of it? Do you have to make any curatorial changes to make it an exhibition rather than a boy's bedroom or a man's den, maybe?
Do you know, that's an interesting question. I'd like to think that I have, you know, donned the cap of gallery curator, because it wasn't just putting 20 records in,
no,
you know, in front
exactly.
and just, I actually had to put Kevin Keegan's This Year We'll Get It Right in a certain position next to a Giorgio Moroder Brazil yeah. record. But on the Panini, absolutely. We literally got sent tons and tons of files. Yes, they were ordered in the year of the World Cup, but I had to just lay them out in a way that when they're placed next to each other across one huge wall, the image is breathtaking. You stand back and you look at it, and it is the art of the World Cup. It's Panini. It's everything that, you know, we went through as World Cup young boys, as fans of, you know, of the World Cup, and indeed collecting stickers. It is actually a real piece of art. So intervention, yes, you have to give it some thought, but at the same time, you'd like to sit back and think of it as a glorified big boy's bedroom.
And the show is called World Cup Wonderland, and it's on at the Proud Archivist in North London. Until when, Rob?
Well, it was meant to be till the end of the World Cup, but it's just so good I can't resist leaving it up there for another 2 weeks. Okay. So
the boy has not been evicted from his bedroom yet. Rob Manley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, Tom, well, that was a decent show. I liked all of those things. It seemed to flow nicely. Went from Poison to the World Cup to,
all points in between.
I think everything looked up after Danny Jacopelli's news look ahead.
That's true. Once you've considered the notion of Daniel Jacopelli naked, it can only get better from there.
It can only really get better, exactly. And PJ Rourke, also a high point. A nice little bit of verbal jousting with Andrew Miller always as well.
Great. Two of my favourite... cantankerous senior citizens. I can't say that.
Yes, you can. You have said it.
I just said it. It's on
You've
air.
Said
oh
it.
My God.
It's on air. And I'm certainly going to be sending both of them a link to that. Shall we thank everyone behind the club? And what's happening next week? We've got more World Cup to look forward to. Obviously.
More World Cup. The World Cup continues seemingly indefinitely, which I welcome.
Do you get that slightly stressful thing when it starts going from like 3 games to 2 games, and then 1, and then the break day, and you're just like, oh God, you're getting kind of withdrawal symptoms?
Yeah, I don't like it. And then it throws open the horrifying prospect of a post World Cup, you know, just the oblivion, the barren landscape.
And then what?
Stretching 4 years hence.
It's all right. We've got the cricket.
That's true.
Yeah.
I can console myself with that.
Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn, and our studio manager, it says in the script, was Claire Urban.
She looks very different.
Very much like Bill Lutie.
Yeah.
There he is.
It is Bill Lutie, you're right. Bill nice frock he's wearing, though.
I was going to say,
he's gone halfway there.
The idea of Bill Lutie in a dress is almost as bad as Andrew Beckham wearing nothing, isn't it? So it just remains for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Tom Edwards.
To say thanks for tuning in.